This episode is brought to you by Ronnie Sue's Chocolates, a confectioner in New York engaged in responsible cacao sourcing from the Toledo district of Belize. Check them out at roni-sue.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 6 of Why Food. I'm your host, Patrick McAndrew. This is a show about people who have made the transition from a past career into the food industry. Each week is a new conversation with a completely different narrative, and this week's guest certainly has a unique story to tell. Ken Friedman's history is in the music industry, where he worked with bands like The Smiths and U2, and Ken opened up a gastropub at 40, which has gone on to, and he's gone on to open up 5 other restaurants with chef April Bloomfield, which include The Breslin, The John Dory Oyster Bar, Tosca Cafe, Salvation Taco, Salvation Burger, and most notably, Ken won the James Beard Award for Outstanding Restaurateur this year. Welcome, Ken. Thanks for joining me.
Great. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It is, yeah. We've got a nice platter of food in front of us.
We sure do. Yeah, we have some meat and pizza.
Ken's got the royal treatment inside.
Well, oh, shucks.
Is this your first time in Roberta's?
No. I love Roberta's. I've been here loads of times. This is one of the places that I get jealous, which is a good thing. You know, I go to, now that I'm a restaurateur, I go to restaurants and one of two things happens. I either hate it because they're just getting it so wrong and I notice every little thing now, or I'm jealous because they get it so right. And I also liberally borrow ideas. I just took a picture of their coffee list, for example, and sent it to all my managers. So, you know, one of the reasons I quit the music business, there were many reasons, but mainly I just had a midlife crisis like we were talking about before. But the other reason is that I just didn't love music anymore. It was my work. And the one negative that's happening now is I sort of don't love restaurants the same because now I'm so close to them that when I go to the loo, if it's a disaster, it ruins my whole evening. Or if on and on and on, you know, if they pour the wine wrong, if they pour too little or too much, or, so you know, that's one of the pitfalls of.
When did that change? When did that focus to zone in on what the restaurants were doing come in? Was that as soon as you opened your restaurant and you were in the zone, or now that you have so many and you have to focus on the good things and the bad things, do you notice what restaurants are doing poorly?
It happened straight away because I looked at restaurants as kind of like, you know, throwing a party. I was throwing a party for my mates. And when you throw a party in your flat, and let's say it's your girlfriend's parents coming or something, and it's the first time you actually noticed how dirty your bathroom is or how, you know, the plant's dead or the goldfish is dead.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
Yeah, so when I used to go to other people's restaurants, I would always sort of take mental notes thinking someday I'm going to do this and, you know, I won't do this, I'll do that, or I'll do it differently. But when I actually walked into my own restaurant, and it's about me, and it's a reflection on me, then it became intense, you know. Then it became something where, you know, I had to notice, you know, every little thing because it was a reflection on me. Same as a chef. If there's a dish that isn't good, a chef will speak of the devil.
That's not true.
Hi, Carlo.
Come on in, Carlo.
Hi, buddy.
That's welcome, good. Carlo.
Nice to see you.
Carlo just came back from the UK. We were just talking about the UK, about the food scene there.
Yeah, what did you think of the food scene when you were out there? We thrust you right in the hot seat, man.
Yeah.
Am I mic'd right now?
Yeah.
You're mic'd. I can hear you.
Let me get my...
We're just talking about the UK and how, you know, when I quit the music business to get into the restaurant business, it was kind of when places like London, places like LA, which had never been considered.
Before we actually
cities.
Get into it, I need to bring it back because it's okay. Unfair not to give you the attention of what you achieved when you were in music. Because if we start your life from 40 onwards, we need to give it justice and go back to the earlier days. What did you do during that time when you were in the music industry?
Well, first of all, no one knows that I'm post 40, so let's start with that.
All right, so you've maintained your 40 for a long time.
So now you've blown my cover. No, what did I do? I mean, I did sort of everything. I played punk rock in bands in high school and college, and I then started putting on shows for all the punk rock bands in California when I was at UC Berkeley. Then I went to work for a guy called Bill Graham, not the Irish Bill Graham, but the American Bill Graham.
He'd be Bill Graham if he was Irish.
Yeah, exactly. but I knew Bill Graham as well. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You're not too young? Yeah, he was a journalist. Thank you. Roberta, the service is great here. You ask for wine, they bring it. See? Wish it worked like that way in my restaurants. It does. Just kidding, GMs. And then I went to work for Bill Graham, big promoter in San Francisco. Was obsessed with British groups and music and the UK, so I became the American manager for a couple of British groups, Simple Minds from Glasgow and UB40 from Birmingham, England, and then moved to London and became the manager of UB40 for the world and the Smiths for the world. I was 25, managing the Smiths and UB40.
Pretty outstanding. How did you get there at such a young age?
No idea. And I mean, people who, like Carla, who know me, you know, when they realize that I was a manager of these big bands, I mean, I need a manager. I shouldn't be a manager. It's crazy that I did. But it sort of worked out. And then I got offered a job, you know, a real kind of job where someone else paid me a salary and stuff. So I moved to New York to work for Clive Davis. I was head of A&R for Arista Records. And then went to another label, London Records, opened up their American office. Got hired by Trent Reznor, who became a friend of mine, to run his label, Nothing Records. I always said it that I was the president of nothing, in charge of nothing, which is kind of what I do now.
You're being too humble. Come on, give yourself a pat on the back. That's pretty incredible what you did at that young of an age. Thanks, Carlo. Carlo will do it for you.
Yeah, he's here for me, yeah. Patting me. Yeah, so then, about that time, mainly, I just had a classic midlife crisis and just wanted to kind of. I didn't want to be that guy that looked back on his life and said, "I wish I'd done this thing that I maybe would have been good at." You know, I wonder if I'd been good at that. And I was lucky; I didn't have a mortgage or kids or a wife or anything like that. So, I left the music business at a time when, like I was saying before, Napster was happening, and Napster to me was like the greatest idea ever, and all the people around me in the music business were suing people personally for swapping songs. And I thought, well, basically, what a bunch of morons. It's a sign. It's time for me to go and do this thing.
Did your love for food, did it come from frequenting restaurants with clients and stuff like that, or did it come from the fact that you had grown up with the love for food, and then because you had the opportunity to go all these restaurants, you got deeper and deeper into it?
It came from going to UC Berkeley and discovering Chez Panisse. That's really where it came from. I discovered Chez Panisse, and what was happening at Chez Panisse, which was my local in college, you know, is where I worked and my girlfriend worked, and that's really what. It was such an exciting place. It was such a temple of a gastronomy. Oh, here he is! Look at Brandon. The boys are back in town. The boys are back in town. The boys are back in town. Hi, guys. Anyway, I'm pontificating. You're leaving? Carl's leaving. Some come, some go. Chez Panisse really was. It was such a cool place, and it was just something was happening there that was much bigger than I'm hungry. I'm going to kill the hunger by eating something. So it was that, and because I was so obsessed with public assembly, because I was in the, you know, I was in the, I played in punk rock bands, and then I started putting on shows, which is, you take a room that is used for this, and then you make it become a room that's used for that, and people come into it, and either it works or doesn't, and they come in for a reason, either to see a band, or to see a performance piece, or to see paintings on the wall, and Chez Panisse was just this, it was just this sort of house nestled at the base of the Berkeley Hills, and it was just this incredible thing. You walked in, it was just bigger than just a restaurant. And so that's what I thought. The restaurants were really cool because I was in the Bay Area at a time when there were so many great restaurants, starting with Chez Panisse, and all the other great restaurants pretty much had a chef or somebody from Chez Panisse that went off to open another restaurant. So it was just, what was happening in, you know, I dropped out of Berkeley a couple times, never graduated. And I always say, you know, because there was so much happening like outside of campus. I mean, there was a punk rock scene happening. It was the biggest, most vital punk rock scene in the world happening in San Francisco then, bigger than L.A., bigger than London. You know, when the Damned came over from the U.K. to do a tour, they were the first British group to do a tour of America. What they found was the Ramones and Talking Heads and Blondie and Television in New York already there before them, and the Nuns and the Zeros and the Avengers and the Dills and Negative Trend and the Sleepers in San Francisco. When they went to L.A., there were no punk rock bands. When they left L.A., there were a bunch of punk rock bands that copied them. But San Francisco, because everybody in every punk band was an art student, as was I. So there was nothing really happening in art then. There was nothing happening in painting, nothing really happening in performance art, basically, was punk rock bands. So it was just it was a time that I forget what my
point was. Was the food scene as captivating then as it is now in San Francisco? Had it found its footing, or was it on the way up?
Well, what happened there was every restaurant, when someone went out to a fancy meal, it was always imported. You know, you go to Italian, it was imported cheese and imported wine. You go to French, everything was imported. What Chez Panisse did was say, you know, the climate here is exactly the same as most of France, right? So I mean, you can grow the same things here that you can in the French countryside. You know, everyone in France gets a Michelin guide and drives on Michelin tires to a restaurant in the country. And the reason why the goat cheese is so good is because the goat's right there, and the lettuce is so good because it's grown right there. Alice Waters at Chez Panisse was the first one to say, well, let's stop getting imported food. Let's just make... There's people making cheese, and if they aren't making it, we'll tell them how to make it, and they'll make it because they have a bunch of goats on a hillside in Marin. And so what was happening was the idea of now it's got this funny farm-to-table name, but it was just the idea of the distance between where it's raised or grown and the plate is as short as possible. And that's what was happening in the Bay Area. There was never American cuisine before. American cuisine was hamburgers and hot dogs and French fries. Right.
It's amazing because no place will ever really find its true understanding as to what the quality of food can be until it does that. Because I had Martha Hoover in here, which I mentioned earlier from the first episode. She was in Indianapolis. She was cooking all this great food at home. But when she would go out and take her kids, she would get things that were processed. She could never get the quality. And she realized that Indiana was such a produce a dominant state.
Yeah.
But none of the food was coming to the restaurants there. So she decided if she wanted to make turkey sandwiches, she'd roast a full turkey, she'd cut it down, and that's what she'd put in the sandwiches. And all the people came in and they said, what are you doing? This is a waste of money and a waste of time. Why don't you just get the processed boar's head stuff that you can do, throw it in, people will love it.
Right.
She said, it doesn't matter. That's not what I want to do. And that was the footing for changing that food scene in Indianapolis, because she went out and made the difference.
Right.
And I think it's when you take that... All it can do is build an experience, because you're taking something from the local region and bringing it into an area so people have a chance to relate to it.
Right.
Because if I started eating foie gras in Galway in Ireland, I wouldn't feel at home. I wouldn't feel that there's any sense of home in the plate in front of me.
But is there anybody in Galway making foie gras?
I mean, right now I'd say there is, yeah. But growing up, I wouldn't have found it. Yeah, Galway is actually the region of gastronomy in Europe for 2018.
Oh, really?
So that goes to show that it's really kind of made its mark on the map there in food.
I mean, it's the same with Ireland. We're talking about Ireland. And you know, like when I go to Ireland, I said, you know, I go spend every Christmas in Wicklow. And I always want to eat Irish cuisine, right? You know, you're in Ireland. But for a long time, my friends who I stay with there and stuff say, yeah, it's only recently that anybody ever really could tell you what Irish cuisine was, except for seafood, I guess. But besides that, like, what's Irish cuisine? Now... There's a, you know, young cooks and farmers are proud of Irish cuisine.
Yeah, you know? It seems to be making use of the land, but there's no reinterpretation of a dish, for example. Like, no one's going to reinterpret an Irish stew to something that's just incredible high cuisine, or no one's going to interpret a shepherd's pie that's going to become outstanding. But it is taking all the products that you can, because Ireland has great land. You can grow so much stuff there, so you can really make amazing food. But I think that's what it has done. People have started to, as we said earlier, go outside the turnips, the cabbage, the suede, the parsnips.
Well, the thing about Ireland is, the dairy is better than anyone in the world.
Oh, it's amazing.
Much.
Yeah.
And the eggs are, I mean, I just think that, you know, to reinterpret a shepherd's pie or a steak and Guinness pie or cabbage and corned beef, just use better quality corned beef, you know, from happier cows, you know? I mean, that's why I think I can't. I haven't been there in a few years, so I don't really know what's going on, but I can't imagine there's not some young chefs or old chefs that are doing that. They're just making Irish classics with better ingredients.
Yes, because there is a gastropub scene, so that's happening. And that's great, but I suppose a country is often, unfortunately, it's kind of gauged on those Michelin star style restaurants. And when, do you know what I mean when I say that there's no footing to kind of work off with that? Because you're not going to see those interpretations on those kind of menus. And it's no complaint. It's just the way it is. And there's still great food to be eaten there.
That's why places like Roberta's and the Spotted Pig are so important. Not just great and taste good and fun, but important because people and indeed Michelin inspectors notice that, you know, you can go have a really incredible meal in a completely different setting than what used to be allowed, you know. So a Spotted Pig or Momofuku Sambar or Roberta's, you can sit on a stool or a chair, and the experience at the table is kind of like a restaurant, even though when you walk in it's crazy and nutty and it's more like a bar, or in this case, more like a, I don't know what.
Well, I think it just, I think the reason why all that is so important is because it brings it down to the social aspect of food, right? Because we have Brandon here. Brandon can attest to that from what it's been like in Roberta's over the years, I'm sure. Because you have great food in front of you, but you have the buzz and the atmosphere, and you feel like it is more of a party because you've people together.
The key word was kind of like a restaurant. I mean, because it is. It's not the traditional setting that you would see as like a Michelin star type of restaurant. I mean, like you were saying earlier, you have this empty space and you try to fill it with something that's important to you, whether it's music or art or some sort of performance. Here we just, you know, our expression was food, and the atmosphere is set by the people and kind of smashing them together and then giving them this product and kind of watching the mix of all of these things together become, you know, a crazy scene.
But one of the things about Roberta's that I always loved from the first time I came here, and I just experienced it now again, at least for me, from getting out of the subway or a taxi, whatever, to, you kind of walk around the neighborhood and you think, at least I think, oh boy, I don't know. And then you walk in and it's like stickers everywhere, and it's kind of like, it looks like somebody just doesn't give a shit. It's just, but then you kind of walk in and it's like, okay. And then then you see the cooks and they're all kind of looking not like cooks are supposed to look. And there's this kind of danger about Roberta's and other places. I mean, my place too, the Pig too, but Roberta's more than any restaurant I know really, where it's like, I don't know. Like, I don't. And often when you bring somebody to dinner and you're kind of like, it was your idea. I've brought people here and gone like, just wait. I know you're thinking. I know you're thinking it's not going to be. And then the food comes and it's like, okay, it all kind of makes sense. And that, you know, that's, and what you've done is kind of the same thing that you weren't here, but I was saying some restaurants I go to and I don't have a good time because they get it so wrong. Roberta's the kind of place I come and I'm jealous. It's like, fuck, I should have thought of that. Like, what a great idea. I wish I could just be happy for you, but I'm not. I'm jealous.
the feeling is mutual.
Good. All right. I want to take a more controlled look at your restaurants, but we're going to go to a break and we'll get back into it and we can touch on the evolution of the Spotted Pig and all the other restaurants.
I'll talk about myself. I love that.
And this one's called Awake by EULA. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Ronnie Sue's Chocolates, the New York confectioner where chocolate begins at the source. Ronnie Sue's own direct trade chocolate is handcrafted in Belize, made with organic Mayan cacao.
We're making the chocolate down there, Bean to Bar, and we employ several folks, local folks, that have learned the craft of chocolate making, and we actually have a factory in Belize. When I say factory, I mean it's like this big. Kind of like, you know, Heritage Radio. We're almost in a shipping container.
Ronnie Sue loves to geek out about chocolate. Come to her atelier on the Lower East Side and get schooled. Sign up for a hands-on make-and-take chocolate truffle class and let Ronnie Sue show you how it's done. Stop by to watch the action in their open production kitchen and enjoy a few chocolates in the secret backyard garden. Take some confections home or shop online at roni-sue.com.
Welcome back to Why Food. I am here with Ken Friedman. I'm here with Brandon, the owner and founder of Roberta's. This is fun. Brandon, you just hopped in and joined us.
Very spontaneous.
Yeah, this has turned into a very spontaneous
show. It looked like a fun room.
Yeah, we've got pizza. We've got some nice cured meats. We've got wine. It's a fun table,
yeah,
I have to say.
Maybe I'll light a joint in a minute.
But, all right, we're here to hear about Ken Friedman. So, Ken, we listened to you and your past in the music industry. Then you had a midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Spotted Pig came.
Yeah.
How did the Spotted Pig come about, and what was your inspiration for it? How did you come to meet April Bloomfield, more importantly?
Well, April, April, I had to find the chef that I wanted. I wanted a chef to be not just an employee, but a partner. You know, I always thought that chef-owned restaurants were better, were cooler. People in the restaurant industry said to me, another reason to have a chef as a partner is, you know, they won't just waste everything, and they'll want to make a profit, and they won't, you know, steal, and they'll watch and make sure people don't steal. You know, just like if I was a pop star, if I was a musician, and I tried to be one, I would be the police. I wouldn't be Sting. You know, I would be a band. I wouldn't be like Bono likes being in a band, right? Even though he's Bono, he likes having people collaborating with him and laying awake at night worrying about the next concert or the next album or whatever. I'm the same. So I was looking for a chef partner, and I looked, you know, and I was an A&R man in the music business most the last 10 or 12 years of my music business career. So I kind of went into A&R mode, started to kind of think about what I wanted, and I didn't just want another kind of guy that used to work for Mario Batali or a guy, you know, a male chef that kicked around. I wanted something different. There were no female chefs, really, when you think about it, back then, 13 years ago. I mean, there were female chefs, but there was nobody that was getting kind of notoriety, or very few. And remember, Alice Waters was my role model. I kind of wanted like someone like her. So I was looking for not just a girl, but something different than what everyone else had. Maybe like a Chinese guy doing Italian food, or an Italian guy doing Chinese food, or something. And I spent 3 years living in London, so that's where I sort of discovered what a gastropub was. And I didn't want to do a British restaurant necessarily, but I wanted to do a place that felt like a bar but tasted like a restaurant, you know. And also I wanted to be like musicians and sculptors and painters who they all make their art for themselves. They don't make it for other people. I think the best artists make albums and stuff for themselves. They don't say what's on the radio. I'm going to make something that sounds like what's on the radio. Same with painters, same with poets, same with anybody, metal workers. So I was a single, straight guy with loved going to restaurants, loved going to bars, went to bars a lot, sat by myself at a bar, you know, would come have people meet me, would never decide to make a reservation in advance, would decide 5 minutes before where we were all going to eat. So I just sort of made a place that took all that into account. No reservations, no dress code. Felt like a bar, but when you sat at the table or at the bar, it was more like a restaurant. A runner would bring you food and know which table to put the plate at, which seat to put the plate at, and lots of wine by the glass and beer by the glass. You know, so I just sort of set out to do something that I wanted to do. And with April, I basically tried to get Jamie Oliver, who was a friend of mine through music business people for years in the UK. I tried to get him to be my chef, and he laughed and patted me on the head and said, I'm not going to be part of your midlife crisis, but I do know a woman. So right away he said woman. I was like, okay, I like that so far. A woman who's a British woman who is the commis chef at the River Cafe in London, which is my favorite Italian restaurant in the world. With apologies to Roberta's and Babbo. Sorry, Mario. So and then she used to work at the Cow, which was like a big inspiration for me. It's a great kind of pub, gastro pub in London, and she worked at Kensington Place, which was just around the corner from my flat. So I'd been there loads of times. So it just sort of felt like before I
did your visions merge as to the food that you wanted to create when you came to meet her and tell her what you wanted to do.
Well, yes, but I had some dumb ideas, which she immediately told me were dumb ideas. Like, I had some friends and a few investors that were vegan. Like, my Moby's a friend, and he's vegan. So I said, you got to make a tofu burger. And she said, I'm not going to make a tofu burger. And I said, you know, you should have like, you know, wings and, you know, American snacky food. She said, I don't want to do wings, you know. I said, actually, I don't want to do wings either. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
So where did you draw the line when you wanted to say that you wanted to do gastropub food but keep it classy? Where did you not want to go above, and where did you not want to go below?
I realized within seconds that April, and if April had not taken the job, the next one, I was going to have to just let that person do whatever that person wanted to do, let the chef do, just like I was in the music business. When I would sign a band, I wouldn't tell them to turn the bass up or turn the drums down or change the sequence of songs. I would let them, if I'm so smart, I should be the chef myself. She never said that to me, but I said that to myself. I'm bringing in a chef to be a partner, and I'm going to leave that chef alone and not tell that chef what to do at all and hope for the best. And that's really what happened. I've never, ever once said, I mean, one time when she asked, I said I didn't love the shoestring fries that went with the lobster roll at the John Dory Oyster Bar because they were cold by the time they got to my plate. It's the only time in 13 years I've ever criticized anything she ever did. And she agreed with me, by the way, on that one. So, yeah.
That's a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, so and she doesn't say to me, I don't like that color, or I don't like the tile in the bathroom. I design the places, or bring in a designer to collaborate with me, not really with us. And she may be interested in design. I've never discussed it with her. I mean, just she does what she does, and I do what I do, and it works. It works really well. Not always. The second restaurant we opened, we had to close, so it doesn't always work. We reopened it. But
which restaurant was that?
The first John Dory. We did a John Dory that was confused, and we didn't really collaborate. And it was in a space that was too little, and we were spending $2 to make a dollar, and it was a big mess. And you know, we were on top of the world. We thought. And Spotted Pig was such a success. We thought, let's do this other thing, the way musicians do sometimes. So I mean, second albums are often dreadful, because the first album is all the best songs of your whole life that you've been saving up, that you put out. It's the greatest hits of your life to that point, as is a restaurant. And the second album is the stuff that didn't make the first album. So it's, John Dory was sort of my idea. She sort of agreed, but wanted to be a little different, but we didn't really discuss it. And I wanted kind of a fancy place, and she wanted a casual place. And it just, we learned how to communicate better after that, how to talk about what are we doing here, you know, together.
So you opened up six restaurants after that. I wish we had time to touch on all of them and discover how they all came and what they are now, but we don't. So can you let me know what it is that is a common thread between those seven restaurants that you have now, that when you and April come to the table to discuss opening a restaurant, there's a few things that don't even need to be discussed because they're the common bond that are going to be shared within each restaurant?
I mean, they're going to be casual, whether the food is fancy on the plate or not. The setting is casual. It's a good question. I'm not sure I even... You know, she's going to, whatever she's doing, wants to do at that point in her life, culinary-wise, she'll just do it. And whatever I want to do, sort of design-wise and concept-wise and stuff, I'll do that. You know, we take reservations at some of our restaurants now, just because it kind of makes sense in some of them.
And do you draw the line similar to someone like, say, Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich, where one says, right, I have back of house, I'm going to take control of the kitchen, this is my scene, you take front of house, you choose the wines, and then we'll see where we can merge here and there? Does it work like that, where there's a cutoff, or is it constantly a collective unison of trying to come up with the ideas that you both want in the restaurant?
It's more the former, but I lean on her. Like she's better than me at walking into a room and just kind of getting it. I kind of like think about it and think about other things besides what's important. She's better. So before we sign a lease, like I want her to go, it feels right because I trust her that way. You know, she's good. I also want her input. Well, she's a better palate than me, so I don't want to like just start decide we're going to carry this coffee without her tasting it, or even with the wine. You know, the wine like in Tosca, I wanted to do. Actually, no, she wanted to do all Italian wines. I wanted to do more California wines. It made more sense to have almost no California wines to go with that. So, you know, we discuss that. And so I lean on her a lot. She doesn't really ask me about food much. I mean, she knows I'm a foodie, and I basically love everything she does so much. I've never had anything that I didn't like. I mean, the way she cooks is exactly what I like. So I kind of leave
her
alone.
You know, there's something
funny
about this. And Brandon, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. I think when it comes to restaurants and a man and a woman get together to open up a restaurant, I think that's when it becomes really, really great, because you get the big ideas and you get the simplicity, you know, where you have someone bring someone back down to earth. When you and Carlo opened the Roberta's, was there a time when you started off in the earlier days and it was the two of you that you had these big bashful ideas and then it came down to a much more simplified version when a lady came on board?
Sure. There is no lady.
Well, no, I don't mean when a lady came involved. But
Carlo is my lady, for all intents and purposes.
Well, there we have it. There was a man and a woman involved in the creation
was a
of
man,
Roberta's.
There was a man and a woman. No, but we, you know, our approach is almost exactly the same, to say that we approach it like a band. And I'm not going to come in and tell him how to play the drums. Like, he's the drummer. And I play guitar, and he's not going to tell me how to play guitar. And like, we don't step on each other's toes. And I think that's the foundation of a good working restaurant relationship. And I the same way, I trust his palate and I trust his sensibility when it comes to the food. And he trusts, you know, my sense of atmosphere and what I believe to be fun. And you know, what we've always tried to do is create a place that's fun. And I think like the food is of the highest priority in creating the atmosphere. The quality of the food is really good, but then outside of that, like, we want people to enjoy themselves and to feel like walk away and feel like that was exciting, mm-hmm. and fun, mm-hmm. and I had an experience, and the experience was surrounded by food. The experience wasn't just food. It was surrounded by food. Mm-hmm. And, like, everything else that happened outside here, you know, like, contributes to the food. And Carlo allows me to be creative on the end of, like, helping create this experience and produce the theatrics of the place while he produces what I believe to be the most important thing, and that's the food.
Do you guys do tastings? Like, does he have you do tastings with him?
I taste, you know, I kind of take it on myself to taste. You know, I grab the guy and something's new that they're working on, and I say, right. Hey, you know, let me try that thing. But again, it's for me, and mm-hmm. And there has been times where I've said, like, you know, probably more than Ken has with just the fries. You know, I said, like, hey, man, I think, like, you know, the guanciale in this dish is, like, too fatty. And, like, maybe something more lean would be, like, you know. And he listens. But if he didn't, it wouldn't be the end of the, like, right. So be it. He's also going to come in and say, hey, man, the army tent is disgusting and gross. And we talk about it all the time. But it's still there. And it's still creating atmosphere, you know. So it's like, we're going to have those moments and those things that we don't necessarily agree on, but again, like, when it comes down to it, I'm going to play the guitar and he's going to play the drums.
Yeah,
lads, I wish we had about another 2 hours, because I'm sure we could have gone way deeper and touched into loads of different things.
Let's just do it,
Brandon. We can't. There's another show coming on after this. Brandon,
we'll have to come back.
Yeah, round
part two.
I'd love to. I love this.
Thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Before we leave, I mentioned this to you before he came on air. I want to know what food has given you before you got into it, or since you got into it.
Well, since I've gotten into the food industry,
yeah.
Well, a bunch of things. I mean, mostly owning something is a great thing. You know, to be able to make money while you sleep, as opposed to most people who are an employee who only make money when they're awake, is a great thing. So, you know, my restaurants are my paintings, my novels. I wrote them, and then for the rest of my life, I'm getting paid for them. It's not just the money, but it's just the feeling of owning something. That's the main thing. But also giving a ton of people jobs, because the people who work in restaurants are the best people in the world. They're all. It's like when I played basketball in high school. It's a team. Everybody looks out for each other, and so that's. I love that. You know, I love our family that we've created. You know, and like Roberta's, aside from the people that you steal from us, we have a lot of people that work in our restaurants. It's a little inside joke. You know, we have people that have worked in our restaurants for 10, 12, 13 years, you know, and that feels good. And we have 401k plans, and it's like it's their career. You know, they're hopefully going to be able to retire from the savings and the 401k that we've provided them with. So I think it's those things that I love.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Ken. I really do think we'll have to do a part two.
Let's do it. Yeah. This is fun.
All right. Let's plan for the future.
Is this live or how is this?
This is live, and then it's going to be going out on iTunes and on Stitcher, and it'll be available on the website afterwards.
So if people go to heritageradionetwork.org?
Dead right. That's where they'll find it. And let me do my final piece.
What a plug.
So thank you, as always, to the people at Heritage Radio Network for giving the industry an incredible platform to communicate and engage. As Ken kindly pointed out, if you want to listen or get more information, you can do that by visiting the website, which is heritageradionetwork.org. I want to say thank you to the great David for producing today's show. And I want to say thank you to all you guys who listen today. The show is available for download on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you enjoyed the show, please rate and review, because it gives the show exposure that I can't get otherwise. If you want to get in touch, my Instagram is patrick.mcandrew. And next week, I'll be chatting with Shen Tong, who is a social activist, investor, and writer, who founded the recent business accelerators Food Inc. and FoodX. I think it's going to be another great show. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.